the morning to you, me lads and listeners. 'Tis a foine St. Paddy's Day. One might even call it a very daily St. Patrick's Day. I'm Ryan. He's Neil. And we thank you for joining us on this special celebration of popular music from Irish artists and musicians. Happy St. Patrick's Day, Neil.
Oh, happy St. Patrick's Day to you as well. No, it's funny. You know, I was not prepared for you to do an Irish brogue when you opened the show, and I should have expected it. And it brings back memories of the very first play I ever did at NIU when I starred in the show Pizzazz, where I played an Irish guy. So I might have to throw that into the conversation tonight that I wasn't expecting, but that brings back memories.
You know what? This didn't even occur to me until now, but when I came out to Vermont and through a friend, I got involved briefly for like 1 or 2 years in the local community theater. Because my friend was directing 12 Angry Men and he needed more guys to fill in the cast.
Right.
So he cast me as, I think, juror number 11 it is. In the play is written as, well, no, actually, I shouldn't say in the play he's written, but in the movie version, he's always kind of portrayed as a sort of meek, nebbish Jew. And I was like, I want that part. And he was like, I was going to give you the foreman. And I was like, no, I want that guy. He's like, why? I was like, because I want to do something interesting with it. And I was thinking of like Benicio del Toro in The Usual Suspects, where I was like, there's nothing interesting about this character on the page. But if I can find something interesting about it. And I was like, I don't want to do a whole lot of preparation. So I worked on an accent for a long time and I was having trouble cracking it. And I finally came up with something that was sort of faux Eastern European, but not identifiably Russian or German or Polish or anything, just kind of somewhere in between there. and then until the dress rehearsal, I was really struggling coming up with this like meek part of me, like this kind of cowardly part of it, partly because of my physicality. I was bigger than most of the cast members. And then I kind of looked at it. I was like, it describes him that way in the stage, in like the roster, the cast like breakdown on the first page. Mm-hmm. Nothing in the actual text of the play informs that or hints at that. I was like, so the audience doesn't know that unless I play that way, and I don't have to. So I actually did it much more combative and was kind of thinking of, this is a weird thing, but Lugash from The Simpsons, the ice skate instructor.
Yes.
And I was just kind of like more combative and upfront. And I was like, it just feels more Russian to me.
Good. See, I was thinking you were going to go the like Tony Kukoc doing The Last Dance. And play that, like, kind of go that route.
No, we didn't have a Jordan and Pippen on the cast, but anyway, yeah, I just thought of that. But like the first time I did like a stage play as an adult, yeah, I did a weird accent, and somebody who knows us through the school was like, I didn't know Ryan was Russian, and Andrew was like, are you kidding me? Like, you've known him for 2 years. Why did you?
Okay, well, we've already gone off on a tangent within the first 30 seconds of the show.
I was going to ask you, though, my lead-off is just, why are we doing this?
There's probably a dozen reasons why we're doing this. Number one, I feel like we've been challenged to do it from our listeners.
Robinson.
Exactly. I also kind of feel like there's been... You know, we're obviously in a Chicago Irish Catholic family. I mean, that's predominantly our upbringing, but it was never like in your face. It's not like, you know, we spent more time with mom's side of the family than dad's side of the family, which is more Irish. But I think that there was always some sort of, the Irish side of the family seemed to have more of the funny stories, more of the funny anecdotes. There was some like, you know, I guess for lack of a better way of explaining it, I feel like I'm already doing a poor job. You know, the weird thing is, you know, on Cinco de Mayo, everybody kind of pretends they're Mexican so that they can drink. St. Paddy's Day, everybody kind of pretends they're Irish so they can drink.
Right.
And yet, I feel like there was something like, I kind of felt a little more like we claimed ownership on, you know, when everybody else would go to the Irish bars and drink on St. Patrick's Day and wear green so they wouldn't be pinched. I always felt like we kind of were like, we could kind of puff our chest out a little bit and be like, yeah, but we really are.
Right.
And there was like a weird sense of pride in like relishing the fact that our history is told through the stories of fights and alcohol.
Top of the morning to ye on this gray, drizzly afternoon. Kent O. Brockman, live on Main Street, where today everyone is a little bit Irish, except, of course, for the gays and the Italians.
I kind of remember having, like, the same experience. I think fourth or fifth grade, I went to school on St. Patrick's Day, wasn't wearing anything obviously green, and the teacher was like, it's St. Patrick's Day, you're going to get pinched because you're not wearing green. And I just kind of looked at her defiantly for being as young as I was, a fifth grader. I'm like, my name is Ryan Patrick Daly. And I didn't know what the word bona fides meant at the time. And I was just kind of like, do I need to demonstrate my Irish? Like, seriously?
Yeah. That's one of those where you look at the teacher and be like, I'm actually Irish. So if somebody pinches me, they're getting punched in the face. That's the definition of being Irish.
And then I'll take him for a beer.
Yeah.
But yeah, and it's a weird way that it manifests. Like, I've always kind of felt this weird national Irish pride that stems more from the popular perception of the Irish in America as drunks, poets, drunken poets, musicians, very, very artistic, very quick to fight, very, downtrodden. And yeah, there was just something about it. Like, I've had that affinity, and without really knowing it or intending to, like, when I was in college, there was a bar in Iowa City called the Dublin Underground, which I went to, and it was cool because it was below street level, like Cheers. So that was one of the draws to it. But yeah, it was this Irish bar. When I went on vacation 7 years ago, it could have gone anywhere in Europe. We chose Ireland. We went to Dublin, and we'll tell more stories about that in a little while. But yeah, it's kind of weird. Like that does instill like a kind of pride that is weird to feel because, yeah, like, again, like not being born there, and Grandpa Daly was our connection to it, but he died when I was pretty young before I had that thing. My name is Ryan Patrick Daly thing before that experience. So,
yeah, I also think in a weird way, like, I think that you're probably the beneficiary of a resurgence in Irish culture in modern, you know, both in music and in cinema and stuff like that. It's gotten popularized a little bit since like the 90s. Whereas I think prior, like, and you may have been too young to remember, but I remember kind of as a kid where it wasn't something to be proud of. Irish people were kind of like the butt of a joke kind of thing. Like, yes, in the 80s and stuff, when I was in school and stuff, it was like, yes, if you were Italian, you were cool. Everybody had their own, like, historical, I guess, naturalized citizenship sort of thing. But there was, Ireland didn't have anything to kind of, like, I mean, they never had athletes in the Olympics. They never had, you know, it was like, I think that there were probably St. Patrick's Days when I was really young where I probably didn't want people to know I was Irish. And then all of a sudden, you know, thank God for better or for worse, I should say. But, you know, it's had this weird resurgence in pop culture where now it's kind of like, yeah, you know, it's anyway, we'll get into this stuff as we go.
And I don't know if there is a direct correlation, but if I had to guess, I would assume some of the popular music is part of that resurgence and part of that more cultural awareness at the time, because we're going to be talking about some of that music, which brings us to the episode proper, what we're going to be doing here. We've each picked a handful of songs from bands or individual artists that have Irish roots, Irish backgrounds. Either they come from Ireland, they grew up in Ireland, they formed in Ireland, or they play a sort of traditional Irish music. And we can talk a little bit about that style and kind of how we identify Irish music. However, in saying that, not all of the songs, in fact, few of the songs that we're picking are going to necessarily sound like traditional Irish songs. A lot of the ones that I picked are just pop songs or rock songs. Could have come from anywhere, but there is that connection, that home, which I will explain in my notes. And then, yeah, we'll share a couple of St. Patrick's Day stories or Irish related stories from our own lives. And then just kind of talk about some of our favorite examples of Ireland in movies, Irish actors, things like that. Like,
yeah. And I feel like, you know, going back to the songs, I feel like this episode is also partially like, we're doing fan service as well, because if we just straight out picked 10 instrumental Irish folk songs or Irish jigs that you'd hear in a bar, like, they all kind of sound the same. So there's not a whole lot to talk about.
We're just covering the soundtrack to Titanic.
Yeah.
Minus the Celine Dion song.
Exactly. So we'll get to, James Horner I found it interesting. I recently revisited the movie The Devil's Own with Harrison Ford and Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt.
And James Horner did the score for that, and most of the Irish score. And then I realized he also did the score for Titanic too. So he's got some Irish roots there. So
yep. Not related to Ireland at all. He did the score for Aliens, which is one of my favorite musical scores.
Yep.
Okay, well, let's get into our...
Although, I'm sure many of our listeners have had a St. Patrick's Day night, which ended up like Alien.
Tell us about it in the comments, people. Leave a comment and a like and share.
How many of you had a xenomorph pop out of your chest at the end?
In there, am I right?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's kick off. Let's get into our music, and we'll sprinkle some of the other stuff as we go. But we're gonna kick off with one of your picks. What you got for us? What is our lead off track today?
Yeah. Well, honestly, this is kind of ironic that it piggybacks on our Titanic conversation. But I'm gonna choose the Irish folk group, pop group, Gaelic Storm. And I chose the song The Night Pat Murphy Died.
Oh, the night that Patty Murphy died is a night I'll never forget. Some of the boys got loaded drunk, and they ain't been sober yet. As long as a bottle was passed around, everyone was feeling gay. O'Leary brought the bagpipes, some music for to play. That's how they show their respect for Patty Murphy. That's how they showed their honor and their pride. They said it was a sin and shame and winked at one another. And every drink in the house was full the night Pat Murphy died.
Okay, this song is kind of fun. I chose it for a couple of reasons. Gaelic Storm has a long, long history of fun party bar songs, pop songs, and instrumental jigs and things like that. This song is technically titled The Night Patty Murphy Died. It's a traditional Irish folk song dating back to, I think, the 1800s. Much of Gaelic Storm's repertoire is kind of tongue-in-cheek, in a sense. This song in particular is a good example of that. It's a fun Irish song about debauchery and shenanigans that go on at your best friend's wake after he dies. So that kind of typical Irish stuff, you know? I chose the song for a couple of reasons, mostly because I wanted to pick a song done by Gaelic Storm, who's a group that we have seen before live as they've toured and played in DeKalb at Egyptian Theater almost annually, I believe. And that's become kind of a running joke in our family. I'll never forget the sitting at Rosita's getting ready for tickets to the dinner with Sue Oram sitting next to us and us going like, uh-oh, there's a storm coming. There's a storm, and she like had no idea we were talking about getting ready to go see Gaelic Storm, and all of a sudden she's like, oh no, where did we park? And all this stuff. So in addition to having seen this group a number of times, most of our listeners will know, going back to what you mentioned prior to in our intro, Gaelic Storm was the steerage band in Third Class in the movie Titanic. They actually were the band that did the soundtrack for the band playing the string, the spoons and the violin and the guitar and all the stuff down in the basement. That's that band. They're actually formed in, I think, Santa Monica, California, and they got cast by James Cameron in that. Ironically, the lead singer's name is Patrick Murphy, which doesn't seem like a surprise if everybody's from Ireland, but that's kind of also the reason I wanted to choose this song. They've got a ton of traditional Irish folk songs. A lot of it is silly, drunken party songs. Their instrumental jigs and classic Irish folk stuff is very, very authentic and very, very good. It proves that they're not just a parody band. They're actually really good musicians. But in the same way, for those of you who know the group Steel Panther and the way Steel Panther is an original band that kind of parodies the 80s, this is the way Gaelic Storm kind of is. It's like they're a fun, modern, party rendition of traditional Irish folk, but they make, I don't want to say parody because that makes it sound like they're a cliche and they're not, but they have fun with it.
I'm glad you picked this one. It is a fun song. It's a jaunty little romp. Makes you want to get up and dance, just like Jack and Rose and Titanic. I think this is a a prime example when we think of, even though it's a modern-ish song in terms of when it was released, but like of sort of a traditional, like kind of classical style in the instruments that it uses. And thinking mm-hmm. about Irish music, there's a lot of pipes and whistles, Irish bagpipes, tin whistles, and also lyrically, it really connects with the Irish tradition of oral stories and telling tales.
Sure,
and
yeah,
a
yeah.
lot of Irish music, like more traditional and a lot of Gaelic Storm stuff, has kind of a narrative form in the lyrics and the vocals, kind of telling a story as opposed to just a verse, chorus, verse, pop type of songwriting.
Absolutely.
And this
absolutely.
Is definitely an example that is really fun. Yeah.
Yeah, and I would probably say, like, this is a good snapshot of what the band, like, if any of our listeners have never heard this, take a listen to the song. If this is kind of, if you think this is a fun spin on St. Patrick's Day, you know, like, you'll probably listen to it once a year, but if this is the kind of song you want to hear on, like, St. Patrick's Day when you're getting ready to go to the bars, this is a lot of what Gaelic Storm sounds like. They've got a lot of songs in this wheelhouse.
Right. All right. All right. Moving on to my first song for this one. And I went with a song that doesn't sound at all like a traditional Irish song. You'd never know. I wouldn't have known, but for the fact that I went to Dublin and this guy was all over the place. But the song is Dancing in the Moonlight. It's Caught Me in Its Spotlight by Thin Lizzy.
When I passed you in the doorway, well, you took me with a glance. I should have took that last bus home, but I asked you for a dance. Now we go steady to the pictures. I always get chocolate stains on my pants. And my father, he's going crazy. He says I'm living in a trance. But I'm dancing in the moonlight. It's caught me in its spotlight.
It's alright.
Dancing all right. in the moonlight. On this long, hot summer night.
Okay, Neil, you probably know this, maybe. The first version of this song that I ever heard, an acoustic cover by our darlings, the Smashing Pumpkins.
Yep.
And I always liked the song. I knew it was a cover. I never thought to actually seek out the original.
I should interject really quick and just point out that Billy Corgan, notable Irish singer from sure. Chicago, like this is all this
the
is
a big Irish family in Chicago. Yeah, yeah.
Sure, yeah.
So this version that you just heard didn't really pop up on my radar until I went to Dublin, Ireland in December of 2016. The band Thin Lizzy and the front man, Phil Lynott, are cultural heroes there. Because we went to the Irish Rock and Roll Museum, which is in the Temple Bar area, which is like a little commercial, like a cultural center in Dublin proper. I'm trying to think of what I might compare it to. Maybe like Melrose Avenue.
Sure.
Temple Bar is kind of like Melrose Avenue.
Yeah, Times Square maybe.
Yeah, something like that. And anyway, like so the Irish Rock and Roll Museum, there's a whole like tour experience. There's videos about like the history of all of these different artists. There's also two functioning studios. And they have memorabilia from like any artist who's ever recorded something there. They have something from Michael Jackson because one time when he was touring, he went into that studio just to lay down some track that he then shipped to New York or his offices or whatever like that.
I'll talk about Michael Jackson later in the podcast.
Okay. They're like, yeah, he was here. Anyway, they also have an entire room dedicated to Thin Lizzy featuring Lynette's bass guitars. His sixth grade report card. There's a wax statue. Tons of memorabilia donated by his mother. And this museum boasts the rich history of Irish rock and roll acts such as Thin Lizzy, The Cranberries, and U2. Those are the three they advertise like on the front poster when you walk in that
wow.
order. They put Thin Lizzy at first.
That's quite.
They are like really proud of this band.
That's like the Mount Rushmore of Irish groups.
Yeah. There's a bronze statue of Phil in the city center. This wasn't a band that I listened to a lot, although I really do like the album Jailbreak, mm-hmm. which is their most famous song, The Boys Are Back in Town. The musical sound of the band is more hard rock, but Lynott's lyrics and his vocals are much more poetic and folk-like. They're often rooted either in Celtic folklore or a very kind of blue collar working class experience. So yeah, I can't separate my experience there going on that vacation and that whole place without this band. Like, even though they do not sound like a traditional Irish band. Like they are heroes there. And I was like, okay, I got to represent them. And I like this song more than The Boys Are Back in Town. I've always like dug this song. So
yeah, that's cool. I'm glad you put some like a personal touch to this story. Interestingly enough, because you and I kind of frequent different circles of or different spheres of influence, one of the guitar players of Thin Lizzy, who wasn't in the band for very long, but his name is Gary Moore, in the guitar playing circle, in the guitar playing industries, he's revered like Eric Clapton. And okay. like he's up there. Gary Moore was in the band for a very short period of time. I want to say like maybe 3 years, like 77 to 80 or something like that. But he is also considered, he's been influenced, like Slash is influenced by Gary Moore. And a lot of people say he was this guitar player from Thin Lizzy also was, he influenced not only like the bands like, there's a lot of like acid jazz fusion kind of stuff in it, but he also kind of gave birth to a lot of like what modern day people say heavy metal. He was a very heavy guitar player and with a famous relic Les Paul guitar that has like lots of people have tried to duplicate and say it's the Gary Moore version. Kirk Hammett from Metallica plays a Gary Moore Les Paul. So he's well revered in that. And of course, me, the guitar player in me thinks of, I listen to the guitar players in bands. The last thing I want to say about Gary Moore, Irish lead singer of the Boomtown Rats, Bob Geldof.
Which
we'll come back to later. Ireland's not a big island. So Bob Geldof proclaimed Gary Moore as perhaps the greatest Irish bluesman on the planet. And I thought that was really, really cool. And that's a neat kind of feather in the cap, so to speak.
Yeah.
So, yeah, other than that, you know, I heard the song for the first time the same way you did from the acoustic cover of the Pumpkins. But, you know, ran out and was like, oh, OK, I got to find out who this was because they covered it. And Thin Lizzy is well talked about and well revered. So this was I guess. To the novice person, it might be a surprise, like, wow, you don't think of them as being on the same bill as the Cranberries in U2. But I'm sure in Ireland, in the motherland, they probably do.
And if we're being honest, maybe it's just because they have the most memorabilia from him because Phil Lynott's mom like donated stuff.
I mean, maybe his mom lives close by.
But they have like I was saying, they have a bunch of stuff. They have like a lot of his bass guitars. There's like a Rickenbacker on display, but also like he was famous for playing a Fender bass. That I thought you might be interested in because of your customization, but the pick guard of the bass was mirror reflective.
And
he was known to like shine it, like let the light reflect off of it and shine it on people in the crowd.
That's very cool. That's the same reason Eddie Van Halen put bike reflectors on the back of his guitar so we could flip it over and redirect spotlight. That's cool. Didn't know that.
All right. What's the next song?
Okay. So the next one I'm going to go with, I'll explain afterwards, but the song I chose was Runaway, and it's by the Irish family group, Andrea, Sharon, Carolyn, and Jim Coors, the Coors.
I would run away. I would run away. Yeah, yeah. I would run away. I would run away.
Okay, so this group, I've got a really cool personal history with, and I couldn't for the life of me tell you where it started. So I'm going to kind of wig in on this. First of all, my research showed that they got their start, and Ryan, you'll appreciate this if you didn't know this. They got their start at an audition for The Commitments, and they were cast as background musicians, and the lead singer of the group, Andrea, who's the lead singer of the Coors, got a speaking role in the movie. So I don't quite recall. I mean, we could Google it. We could Wikipedia.
It's been so I know the soundtrack, but it's been so long since I've seen the movie.
Yeah, but I know that you have a firm like right. This is one of your faves. So I thought that was really cool. Well, anyway, so going back to that, so their audition, John Hughes apparently saw them, loved them, got them a manager who connected them with Glenn Ballard, the producer who you people might recognize from Alanis Morissette's early work. And that's kind of how they got the record deal. Now, this is the part of the story that I can't put my finger on. I don't remember exactly how I heard of them or why. And more importantly, I can't remember why our dad was in Los Angeles in the late 90s by himself without mom or you. But dad and I went to see them at the House of Blues on Sunset Boulevard. So somehow, some way, we knew who the Corrs were. And dad was in LA by himself. I don't even know if he stayed with me. I cannot figure this part of the story out. I'm not joking. I have no idea. I don't know if I was in a relationship with Tina at the time and he stayed in a guest room, or did I live by myself, or couldn't tell you. Dad doesn't know because I asked him. He was like, I have no idea why I was there. Maybe we might have tracked it down to a time where he flew to Vegas in March to meet me, and I drove to Vegas and we saw like March Madness games and bet on some games. But he doesn't think he came back to LA. He thinks he flew back out of Vegas. So we don't know, but we both know for a fact that we saw the Corrs at the House of Blues. So somehow, some way, they were on my radar. That's my point. My point is that somehow I knew who they were before the rest of the world did, and I thought that they were really cool, this cool Irish family doing like a Partridge Family thing with Irish folk music. Now, since that time, they've gone very mainstream. They've gone very pop over the years and had mainstream success. They famously covered Dreams, Fleetwood Mac's Dreams by Stevie Nicks, and they re-released a second album of their own music with like a DJ, like a techno kind of DJ, made it a very dance pop album. Not one of my favorites. I like more of the original stuff. But either way, they've each album that they've ever put out has a handful of 1 or 1.5 minute Irish instrumental jigs, just to kind of show that these guys all play their own music. Jim plays guitar, piano, bass. I think Carolyn plays the drums. Sharon plays the violin. Andrea, who sings, also plays the piccolo and the flute, and they're fantastic, a fantastic, great live band. And I like a lot of the instrumental stuff. Like for anybody listening out there, there's a couple of instrumentals, and they're all really short. They're like interludes. There's a song called Carol Jig. There's a song called Toss the Feathers. I love them. It's very Irish roots instrumental stuff. This song I chose, the reason I chose the song Runaway, was because this one probably bridges the gap most between their Irish roots and their pop sensibilities, because they've got songs that are heavily rooted in each direction. Some of their pop songs are very, very pop, and you'd have no idea they're from Ireland. This song I chose because I feel like it straddles the line the most.
Yeah, I mean, it was their big pop hit, Breathless, was the one that brought me to their attention, which I thought was a great pop hit at the time that it came out. Mm-hmm. I also really like, they did a live performance maybe a few years after that, and they covered Ryan Adams. They covered the Ryan Adams song, When the Stars Go Blue, and Andrea did it as a duet with Bono. And it was really pretty song. I mean, I really love the original version, but their cover of it, their harmony was really, really pretty. And yeah, and this one, Runaway, is also just a wonderfully pretty song. Very cool, very kind of intoxicating. I love looking at like a snapshot of the band, or like looking at the list, and you've got the three girls and their names, and then just Jim, just the one guy in the band is just Jim.
Jim. The funny thing is, he does like the most James in the band. I know, he does the most, and but it's really fun. But even when you see them live, like and again, I've seen them live. It's funny how the girls are so far in front. Even Carolyn, the drummer, has a drum solo in their concert. Whereas Jim is just Jim. Just Jim.
Yeah. All right. The next one, Nothing Compares to You by Sinead O'Connor.
Guess what he told me? He said, girl, you better try.
All right. This was the biggest hit single from 1990 from O'Connor's second album, I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got. The song was originally written by Prince, as listeners of our podcast will know, and it was released by his side project, The Family, before he gave the song to Sinead O'Connor. In 1990, I was still pretty young and not really finding my own taste in music, but Sinead's version wasn't really in my bag. I knew it had a very popular music video because much of the video is just one long, extremely close shot of Sinead O'Connor, whose hair was short, almost shaved, and she wasn't trying to look like a pretty girl or like the Bangles or the Go-Go's or anything like that. She even cries during the video. And just nothing about that appealed to me in 1990 when I was just like very young, very superficial as a music fan. So I never really even tried to pay attention to this song at the time until almost a decade later when I got the triple disc Prince singles and B-sides collection, which included a live performance he did of Nothing Compares to You with a woman, Rosie Gaines, also on vocals. And we've talked about this one before. Mm-hmm. I loved the Prince version. It's an awesome song. It's a great bluesy, soulful ballad, wonderful duet. And I also read in the liner notes how Sinead didn't even thank Prince when she won the Grammy for her cover of the song. And there was bad blood between them. So I was very, very anti Sinead O'Connor and her version of the song, even though I had barely heard it, because I was only getting Prince's side of the story. And that's how I felt for about 20 years. Then, before Sinead O'Connor died, I saw a video of Pink covering this song. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful and heartbreaking and powerful, but I knew she wasn't doing Prince's song. She was covering the Sinead O'Connor version. And I also heard Chris Cornell, the late singer from Soundgarden and Audioslave, he did an acoustic cover of the song, which was equally beautiful and powerful. But he was also doing the arrangement of the Sinead O'Connor version. Mm-hmm. And this was kind of chipping away at me. And then Sinead O'Connor died last summer. And I made myself listen to her version and really sit with it for the first time ever. As a Prince fan, it's hard to reconcile the idea that somebody may have done a Prince song better than Prince. Especially when, as I said, his version of the song, the live version anyway, is awesome. But her version is better. And you can see the evidence in the music video with that close-up of her face. Prince's song has soul. It has his soul.
Yeah.
But I don't think he brings anything to that he didn't bring to his other songs. And that may be evident in the fact that he was willing to give the song away and didn't do a studio version of him of his own. Sinead O'Connor, on the other hand, brings everything to this song, including her very real and very recent grief. Yeah. The song is about lost love. Sinead's mother had died a year before the album I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got came out. And Sinead has said that her mother was both physically and mentally abusive, but it was still her mother. And a lot of what went into the songwriting of that album was her coping with that loss. She did not write Nothing Compares to You, but she did help rearrange the song and recontextualize it. Because the words may sound like she's singing about a boy who left, but the pain in her voice and the tears streaming down her face in the video, that's the loss of her mom there. So when I heard that, I was like, okay, we should do a St. Patty's Day episode. I was like, well, I've hated the song for the wrong reasons. It is really remarkable. And I had to talk about it because also she's one of the most famous, Irish artists and musicians of all time, in terms of like mainstream popular culture and awareness for, even including things that she has done outside of the realm of music, which we also maybe come back to in a little while. But yeah, that's the song. I had to pick this song. I had to talk about this, and I had to kind of admit to myself begrudgingly that, yeah, and you know what? Maybe Cyndi Lauper's version of When You Were Mine is better than Prince's too. Anyway.
Well, okay. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Yes, we do have to talk about this if we're doing a St. Patrick's Day podcast. This was, I mean, there was I'm with you. You know, I was in the Prince camp, and I remember that she didn't thank him. And then I remember, you know, she seemed to rub everybody the wrong way afterwards, and did kind of every step she took seemed to be like the wrong one for a while. And people wanted to turn against her. But there was a reason the song was as big a hit as it was. It's because it's really damn good. It's just that damn good. When you described the video, I'm glad you didn't compare it to D'Angelo's video. right, that's where I thought you were going, because
there is a commonality, but it's more in the setup of the shot.
But a little bit. Also, I think we should point out, you know, we should all probably drink the same Kool-Aid that Pink drinks, because everybody else that sang the song has died. So that's whatever she's doing. That's good for Pink. Yeah, I really don't have anything else to add to it. I think you touched on everything, and the rest, you know, a lot of this stuff is common knowledge, and a lot of this stuff is what us Prince fans, you know, kind of dug up over time. But much like you, I would say my stance on the song has softened over time. And, you know, I'll be the first to admit, whether it's cliche or not, you know, I probably hadn't heard it in 20 years until she died. And then I revisited it. And wow, you know, maybe, you know, I'm at a different place in my life. We're adults now, you know, and it's like, oh my God. Yeah. You hear the pain, and the performance of the song is transcendent. It's really, really good. Ironic little footnote to your story about her, her being on bad terms with Prince. I read a bunch of different stories about what they had against each other. And
if you're a Prince fan, it doesn't make you feel good.
No, it doesn't. But I footnoted a couple of the funnier versions of the story, because if anybody has seen Charlie Murphy on Dave Chappelle's show or saw Prince on New Girl, this will make sense to you. Uh-huh. One of the stories that Sinead O'Connor has said, and again, she's struggled with some mental health issues and stuff, so we don't know how much to put stock in her in her memoirs. But one of the things that she said was that Prince made her come to his house while they were working out this song, and he wanted to serve her soup, and she didn't want soup. She wasn't hungry. And he said, no, you have to have soup. And she said, no, I don't want it. And he forced her to have a bowl of soup before they could talk about the song. That's probably the only thing that I want to bring up in the sake of this, because the rest, you know, he got things that he got mad at her for swearing during interviews and all kinds of stuff. And he was a taskmaster, and, you know,
the story gets uglier from there. We'll leave it out.
It does. And I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but I think it's, I, the soup story I thought was hysterical, and that's coming from her. So I just thought it was great. And there's also a little bit of that Coming to America bit in it. Like, you know, like, try the soup. What's wrong with the soup? You know, that's all I can hear. It's like, no. Is the soup too hot? No. Just try the soup. Just try. Is the soup too cold? No. Just please do me a favor. Try the soup. Where's the spoon? Aha.
Aha. Okay. Pressing pause on our track list for a minute. There was a story that when we said that we had to kind of share some family anecdotes, there is not so much a story, just kind of a situation that I think we've talked about our family enough that the listeners should deserve to know this part about our family history, because I know it and I've got to pass it along. So this concerns our grandparents on our dad's side, obviously his parents. His father's name was Christopher. He went by Christy. There's another side anecdote where the first time I heard that, I asked him what his name was, and he said Christy. And I said, that's a girl's name. And I remember that being a story that Dad and Mom would later tell the Pavankas. It was too much comic relief. But and Grandma's name was Jules. Grandpa Christy had a brother named Pat. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, he did.
Yeah.
And before Grandma and Grandpa were married, great-uncle Pat was dating Jules, our grandmother. He broke up with her because he met a woman named Fran, and they got married. And then Jules got married to Pat's brother, Christy, our grandpa. Mm-hmm. So two brothers in this family both were seeing our grandmother. when one broke up with her, the other one married her. And yet, you would think, oh, this might be a little bit awkward. This might be some cause of stress or something. They were best friends, the four of them. Like, I think they lived together for a time. When Dad or Aunt Mary, her dad's older sister, was telling me the story, I'm like, these people are just weirdos. How should Jews act? Like if one of us decided to date the or marry like the ex-girlfriend of the other one, it's like that might be an issue. I don't know that we would have the same friendship, but they got over it. And for whatever reason, I've just always thought about that Grandpa and his brother both saw Grandma at one point in time, and it never, at least to hear the stories told about it, it wasn't a hiccup in their relationship.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, now that is not even close to the story I thought you were going to tell. And I feel like the story that I want you to tell, because I wasn't privy to it firsthand, you were as a child. I just, you know, and it may be just a typical, like this happens in every Irish family's household, but Uncle Mike's ex-wife Stella pulled a gun on Dad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, again, maybe this thing happens in all Irish families, you know, maybe that's, you know, somebody's always a cop and they have a gun, but
they were trying to clear out the grandparents' house after they died, and they were trying to move everything out, and Mike didn't want to empty it out.
Essentially.
Yeah. He was living there and things got heated, and Mike's girlfriend Stella was a cop at the time, and she pulled a gun. Force everybody to leave. And I was just sitting there with a coloring book. All right. This is interesting. Where is this going to go?
Yep. This is, and the only reason I bring this up is because, you know, I had this rather unfair reputation of exaggerating a lot of my stories, which I don't know where that comes from. But this is one of those indicative stories where when I tell people like, oh, yeah, you know, like this is typical Irish families. Like my dad's brother had his ex-wife pull a gun on my dad and his sisters and because they were fighting over the house and she pulled a gun. And everybody's like, oh, OK, yeah, whatever. And I'm like, no, honest to God, that happened. Like that really happened. So this is, again, chalk one up for the Daly family.
I only have two real vivid memories of that house, the grandma and grandpa's house that they were living in at the time.
I'm surprised you have any, to be honest.
It was not much. One of them is that of the gun incident. The other one was before grandma died. Mom and I went there just by ourselves for some reason. It wasn't like a family get together, but mom was talking to grandma about something. And I was just wandering and exploring the house, and I went up into the attic. Cause there was like a second floor attic or whatever that you could just, there was just a staircase. It wasn't like a ladder or anything like that.
Yeah, I don't think I ever saw that.
Yeah. There was like, and I just kind of went up there and I was just like roaming around the attic and everything. And they're like, okay, nothing up here or it's kind of creepy. I'm going to leave. And I turn around and grandma's cat is sitting on like the landing, kind of blocking my exit. And this thing was this smoky gray cat with fierce green yellow eyes that looked exactly like the thing from Pet Sematary. And when I say this cat blocked me from coming down, I mean, every step I took to approach, it would just and bar these enormous fangs and these sharp teeth and everything, and would like step to like it would like I couldn't come down. It would like approach me and everything like that, and I was just like, this cat just unnerved the hell out of me, terrified me. I was like, this thing is going to attack me. And I was still just a little kid, so I think I just started crying and screaming for mom, and then she came and got me, and they shoot away the cat. I think grandma was like, I don't have a cat.
I feel like it makes me wonder if it was like a shapeshifter or something. Like
probably. That. It was a leprechaun.
I only remember the dogs, Toto and Scotty. Those are the two dogs that I remember. I don't remember. You probably don't even remember them.
The name Scotty. I remember that dog, but yeah.
So the other thing that I thought was funny in this, and then we can get back into the music in a second, but this is really good. So I used to frequent an Irish pub in Burbank, California, across the street from Warner Brothers. Ryan, you might have gone there with me. Not the Snug. I'm not thinking of the Snug. There was a place called Timmy Nolan's. And I kind of always went to just Irish pubs. In the bathroom of this place, total typical Irish dive bar, they had a map on the wall, big wall-sized map that you could trace your family, Irish family lineage, to a chart with your name, your family crest, and the clan that you were from, the area, and then your, like, family's notable history. And it was pretty cool. It was really neat. Like, I'd never been one that I'm not like, I don't give a shit about those 23andMe or those kind of things. Like, I don't care about that stuff. So I never thought about tracing my family history. But this was just, it was there. It was like when you wash your hands by the sink, you're staring at this thing. And Bailey was on the list. So I checked it out and I looked at it and then followed it over to the chart and everything. And it was kind of neat because the name Daily, as we spell it, D-A-L-Y, was originally spelled O'Daly because there was an O in front of everybody. And then even the name, the spelling of Daily changed over time. We've shortened it and made it very commercialized American, but it used to be like O-D-A-I-L-E-I-G-H kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the O'Dalys were famous in the field of literature from the 12th to the 17th century. This stuff was fascinating to me because not that I believe in these weird things, but you and I are writers, and I'm like, oh, the Dalys are famous for literature in the field of literature. Many O'Dalys were hereditary poets. And here's the thing that I thought was the coolest. And in more recent times, the most prominent occupations of the Dalys were three things: singers, boxers, and bar owners. And in other words, it's everything I've ever aspired to be. It's like everything I've ever wanted to be. But I do recall, Ryan, and this may be even before your time, I think, like, obviously the bar owners thing is a joke. Everybody in Ireland.
Right.
Like, that's neither here nor there. Grandpa Christie used to sing all the time on Christmases. I remember being really young, but he would just break out and start singing. And everybody else just thought that was normal. And I, as a child, was like, why is this guy just singing at the dinner table? Like, that's so bizarre. Right. And it was classic traditional Irish songs and stuff. And I was just like, this doesn't seem weird to anybody. But he had a really, really good voice. He actually could sing. And then there were stories that they would share about him fighting people, being a prize fighter. And stuff like that. So I thought this was so weird. And then I remember one time asking like mom or dad or something like, hey, you know, how did Grandpa Christie ever try to be a singer? Was he like, why, you know, all this stuff? And they're like, no, he just does that when he's drunk. And I was like, okay. So that's why everybody ignored him. They're like, he got to that point when it was that point of the night, a typical Irish Catholic Chicago family, he gets drunk and he sings or he punches people. So
The other kind of connection with the Daily, the family, the clan and everything, having their roots in literature, poetry, singing, and sort of oral storytelling, that kind of tradition, is Grandpa Daily grew up in the town of Limerick. I think it's called Limerick.
Yes, that's right. Which he told dirty jokes.
Yeah. And Aunt Mary, Dad's oldest sister, I remember telling her, I think it came from her, but maybe it was from Uncle Patterson. Somebody was telling the story about how when they were growing up in Limerick or something, or just like in the city, the kids would be out playing like in the streets, you know, football or stickball or whatever they were doing like at the time. And a building would blow up because of the IRA or something like that was going down, or like some group would just blow something up. And then they would like run back inside and then like the smoke would clear and they'd be like, all right, let's go back out and play. And that was just like an everyday occurrence that was very normal for them.
Wow, that's amazing. And yeah, we'll talk about once we get into like pop culture movies and stuff like that, there's going to be a whole lot of them.
The other one notable story that I remember about Grandpa Daly, and this might be apocryphal, I don't remember when or how I heard this, but that at one point he was a tailor's apprentice or something like that in Chicago, and his boss or like his whoever, like his senior, made a suit for Al Capone. And we're like, wait, I was like, wait, did Grandpa make a suit for Al Capone? They're like, no, Grandpa, he wasn't that good. He wasn't that good, but he was like in the store or like in like part of that or something. I don't know if that story is true, but I always thought that it was a missed opportunity that you never wrote a song called Grandpa Was a Haberdasher.
Well, see, and I think a better story would be about how Grandpa sewed a secret shiv inside the suit for Al Capone. Like, that was all part of the Irish mob connected to the Italian mob, like Gangs of New York style.
Right. All right, we're getting back to our playlist again, and we're switching order here because I'm going to pick up again. And the next one is a song by an artist that you mentioned earlier, which is the song I Don't Like Mondays by the Boomtown Rats.
silicon chip inside her head gets switched to overload. And nobody's gonna go to school today. She's gonna make them stay at home. Daddy doesn't understand it. He always said she was good as gold. And he can see no reasons, cause there are no reasons. What reason do you need to be shown?
If you're not familiar with the Boomtown Rats, you are familiar with their frontman, Bob Geldof. And even if that name doesn't ring a bell, you've heard his work because he was the architect of Band-Aid and the international Super Smash hit, Do They Know It's Christmas? And after that, he formed Live Aid, the concert series. In the late 1970s and early 80s, Geldof was the lead singer of this Irish new wave band called the Boomtown Rats. This song, Geldof was inspired to write after a mass shooting at Grover Cleveland Elementary School in San Diego, California, by a woman named Brenda Spencer. Spencer murdered several kids and adults, and when she was asked about it, she said her reason was, "I don't like Mondays." And
I really don't mean to laugh at that, but that's...
It's preposterous. And the song was not written as any type of social commentary. He wasn't critiquing or opining on the epidemic of gun violence in America because it was 1979.
Right.
We didn't have that kind of awareness. He was simply trying to articulate a situation that is impossible to understand. The mass murder of children at school with the absurd question, tell me why. Yep. And the equally absurd answer, I don't like Mondays.
Yep.
There is a recurring theme to a lot of Irish songs and music, which is some sort of call for justice, social justice, activism, struggles against oppression. We see it in U2 and Sinead O'Connor and the Cranberries. Obviously, it was important to Geldof later in his career, maybe not when he wrote the song, but you know, he wasn't just a musician. He was an activist, heavily involved in charities that benefited impoverished people in countries, human rights. That's hence, you know, Band-Aid and Live Aid and the formation of this. But it's impossible not to think about this song when we have mass shootings 3 times a week in this country. And I don't want to turn this into a political thing. I think it kind of speaks for itself, but it ain't nothing new. Like this was something in 1979 and nothing has changed.
So. Yeah. Really good song. As a matter of fact, you know, I remember when the Boomtown Rats were on MTV in the early 80s and stuff. They were new wave, so it wasn't really my bag kind of thing. It wasn't my sound. But I remember this song was a good song choice. Ironically, like some of the stuff that I looked up on them, some of their earliest hits, including this one, were produced by Mutt Lange, who was famous for Def Leppard in the mid-80s. Great producer. Bob Geldof, obviously you talked about him. I should point out that he was the star of the movie Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Yes, he
acted in that, which again, it was kind of like, I don't know how that ended up happening. I do think it's great that you picked this song. And it brings me like most people that are listening to this, I think that their connection will probably be more to Live Aid and to Band-Aid than anything else. But I think it's ironic that I just recently saw the We Are the World documentary on Netflix called Pop. And Bob Geldof has an appearance in that because We Are the World came about only because of Bob Geldof putting together Band-Aid and doing Feed the World, Do We Know It's Christmas? So that was amazing. What this man has done for the world, for charity, for world awareness is unparalleled. Unparalleled. And I'll come back to Live Aid later on in the podcast when I go to one of my other songs. But yeah, tip of the hat to Bob Geldof for sure.
Yeah. And another recurring theme in my song choices, which will continue later on too. The first time I heard the song, I don't think it was the Boomtown Rats version. The first version of this song I heard was a cover by Tori Amos, who despite not having any connection to Ireland that I'm aware of, if you were to cast somebody who looks like she was born in the countryside of Ireland, Tori Amos would look like that. She looks like an Irish spirit.
Yes. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I can see her in like the Banshees of Inisherin or something. Like, absolutely. She looks Irish.
All right, what do you got next?
Okay, so the next song I'm going to choose is probably the biggest stretch genre-wise for any of our hits, that this sounds the least Irish of anything we're choosing. I'm choosing this pop disco song, Let Me Know, by Roisin Murphy. So let me tell you a weird, really weird roundabout way how I discovered this person. She had a song, Rama Lama Bang Bang, which was a dance pop kind of trip hop song on a Halloween episode of the TV show, the competition show, So You Think You Can Dance. And the choreographer, Wade Robson, did a Victorian vampire piece where everybody came out. It was a dance piece. But to this song, which was kind of creepy and eerie, only when you put it with the dancers in stage in vampire and zombie makeup.
Sure.
And it was really neat. But I remember loving the song and thinking immediately, that has to go on my Halloween playlist. So I had to do some digging into that. By the way, I mentioned earlier that Michael Jackson would come up during this podcast. I just want to point out really fast, and we'll go over this. Wade Robson, people may know him from the Netflix documentary on Michael Jackson on lawsuits and things like that, the abuse. Wade Robson was one of the kids that was abused by Michael, apparently. I'm not going to cast judgment. Anyway, so that brings me back to this Roisin Murphy. So I did some digging, and I really liked her style. She had a very interesting, eclectic kind of thing about her. And she it wasn't all techno, it wasn't all pop, and it wasn't the Christina Aguilera type of voice. So I did some digging. She was emancipated from her parents at age 15. She moved to London for a little while and then moved back to Ireland. Now she lives in Ibiza, believe it or not. But she's been making music ever since she was 15 on her own. She's been described by the European media as like a global or European Lady Gaga. She blends styles of hot jazz, trip hop, funk, and electronica. The reason I picked this particular song, however, was because for some reason, and I like a lot of Roisin Murphy. I've got a playlist of Roisin Murphy, and it's a good fun party background music kind of thing. This song has a little bit of vintage disco in it, and there's something I like about it. It kind of brings me back to like a Bee Gees kind of song or an Olivia Newton-John or something. Like, there's something about that. Yep. If you check out some of her acoustic versions, and if anybody wants to look her up and go to YouTube, she's done some of those tiny desk type performances, during COVID. She did a lot of her hits with just a guitar player. And there you can kind of hear the Irish folk upbringing a little bit. It sounds a little more traditional Irish folk, even when she's doing a pop song. And you can see the way she sings and carries herself. But this song I dug, it doesn't sound very Irish, but I dig the disco vibe for it. And this is one of my, I will say almost without a doubt, I bet you this is the least known Irish artist we have on our list.
Probably, because I wasn't familiar with her until you brought her to my attention for this. And you sent me a couple of different tracks to kind of sample, and I thought this one was the best. And again, it doesn't sound necessarily Irish. That is evident in some of her other songs. But as just what you perfectly described it, I had the same note. It feels kind of like a throwback disco track. Mm-hmm. And I really dig it. I like the video for this. It was just, it's a cool dance song. It's a fun one. Spinning out of like discovering her and thinking about her. The Gaelic language is kind of preposterous. The way You'd think something that sounds phonetically so close to English, but it like just the words are pronounced so crazy. And we talked a little bit about this, the fact that on Halloween, the spirit Samhain, it looks like it's written Samhain,
yeah.
but it's pronounced Samhain.
Yep.
The instrument I was talking about before, the Irish bagpipes that are prevalent in a lot of those songs, they're actually called Illan pipes or Illan instruments. There are 8 letters in the word.
Yeah.
And it's like, how does a word that long just sound like Illan? And it's like, so yeah, ridiculous. Like, so yeah, her name looks like Roisin Murphy, or like you're misspelling Raisin, but it's Roisin. There's this whole little bit about where Liam Neeson does a PSA for Irish name awareness, where he talks about, where he corrects everybody's spelling. He's like, it's Killian Murphy, not Cillian guy that's all in Christopher Nolan's movies.
Yeah, well, it's funny, going back to what I was saying about the original spelling of the O'Daly's, that's a 10-letter word. It's a 10-letter word. If you spell it out phonetically the way, or not phonetically, the way it was originally spelled in the Irish brogue, that's the sense. Yeah, so Roisin Murphy, this name just popped into my head, and I'm trying to think of a comparison for people out there. I think she's like kind of a modern-day Bjork. That would be like That would be a name that I would pick. Kind of eclectic, kind of weird. Not necessarily a great singer, but an interesting and unique singer.
Sure.
That's where I would kind of put her.
It brings a lot of herself to all of her work and stuff. Like, yeah, I can see that. So. All right, my next one... from an artist that we've talked about, Damien Rice, and the song is 9 Crimes.
Leave me out with the waste. This is not what I do. It's the wrong kind of place to be cheating on you. It's the wrong time. She's pulling me through. It's a small crime. And I got no excuse, and is that all right, yeah? I give my gun away when it's loaded, is that all right, yeah? If you don't shoot it, how am I supposed to hold, is that all right, yeah? If I give my gun away when it's loaded, is that all right, is that all right with you? That all right, yeah.
All right, Rice is probably best known for his songs The Blower's Daughter or Cannonball, two very kind of like romantic love songs. But this has always been my favorite of his songs, and a song that I listen to quite often still. Like this is in a heavy rotation in my just kind of general random playlists. What struck me the first time I heard it was not just this haunting melody and the beauty of the duet harmony, but the subject matter and the perspective on love and guilt and betraying that love, and not being defensive about it or accusatory, but just kind of full of a little bit of self-hate and recrimination. It was just like unlike any song that I had ever heard before, possibly since. The other singer on this, who isn't credited, but the woman who sings the female part is Lisa O'Hannigan. God, no, I can't think. It's either Lisa Hannigan or O'Hannigan. And she's collaborated with Damien Rice on a lot of projects. And she's also got her own solo stuff. They're beautiful together on the song. But one of the reasons why I had to pick this one, as a personal connection, I listened to the song a lot in the late aughts, which was, interestingly enough, around the time that I got married. And I remember a day when Angie and I were in the car driving and listening to this song, and we both started singing it. Before long, we started harmonizing as best we could, neither of us being great singers, but we were taking the parts and singing it together. And right in the middle of it, we kind of look at each other with these absurd smiles, and I'm like, we both know they're singing about infidelity, right? I just want to make sure we're both on the same page as we're singing this. Like, this isn't ironic, is it? And we're like, yeah, okay, we know. It's like, okay, all right, then proceed. We just kind of went. So, I've always liked the song. I think it's a bold choice to have this kind of approach to the subject matter. Even bolder still to use a gun as a metaphor for your penis or a loaded gun. So. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's it. What do you think about this one?
First of all, I'm surprised you didn't reference the video, because the video for it, for anybody that hasn't seen it, it's very, very, it's interesting. It's great CGI, but the woman's part is sung by a decapitated head.
Right.
And it just adds like a whole different sort of levity to this, to the subject matter. Really interesting. It's a really, really good song. I'm glad you picked this. Obviously, you know, when we first discussed doing this, Damien Rice was on my radar as well for all the reasons you mentioned. There were other songs that I might have chosen. I'm glad you picked it so I didn't have to, so I didn't have to lose an artist based on him. Damien Rice, although he's probably not super mainstream named, he has influenced a ton of people like Ed Sheeran, James Blunt, Louis Capaldi. A lot of singers credit Damien Rice for the bringing back the whole kind of singer-songwriter, the folk singer-songwriter kind of thing, and making it modern pop. I really don't have anything else to say about it. You described the song perfectly. Damien Rice is probably, well, I mean, he's certainly up there with, you know, for the last song I chose, which was the most un-Irish type of thing we did, Damien Rice might be the most Irish guy that we do on this podcast.
The only other thing, I just discovered this last night, and it connects to one of the previous songs that I talked about. There is, you can find it on YouTube, there is footage. Damien Rice was doing a concert the day that Sinead O'Connor died, when he found out about it. And it's actually the audience tells him, and they're kind of like shouting at it, and he's trying to like figure out, he's like, what about Sinead O'Connor? What are you talking about? And then he's like realizing, he's like, she died? It's like, this just happened? How do you know? And he's kind of figuring, and he's processing it, and he's just kind of like still in the middle of like tuning his guitar and kind of doing this thing. And he eventually kind of, you can see him starting to think about it. He's like, do I know the lyrics to that? And he starts doing a version of Nothing Compares to You as a tribute. And it was crazy because it was spontaneous. You can see him in the moment hearing this news and just start thinking, he's like, I have to pay tribute to this amazing artist, this amazing woman. And like he doesn't get the lyrics right. Like you could see it's like it's sort of like he's trying to like,
well, that probably saved his life based on what we talked about before.
that's why I still like, because he didn't cover it perfectly. All right. Before we go into our last leg of songs, something else that we teased, and you mentioned recently watching the movie The Devil's Own.
Yeah.
Just favorite examples of Ireland, Irish culture, other things in movies, TV, pop culture, favorite performers, actors, and stuff like that?
Sure. Well, I tried to do this completely off the top of my head without doing any research, but I didn't want to miss anything. But I was pretty accurate with a bunch of them. The first couple that come to mind immediately that I didn't have to look up, some of my favorite Irish movies are The Devil's Own, which we talked about, the aforementioned Harrison Ford and Brad Pitt movie, The Boondock Saints with Sean Patrick Flannery and Daryl. I just call him Daryl from The Walking Dead. One of my all-time favorite Irish movies. And it's a movie that I, for some reason, I feel like they kind of borrowed from yours and my life. You know, I feel like that's how they put that together, because that movie is identical to our upbringing, identical. In recent years, The Banshees of Inisherin and in Bruges, are those, like that style of comedy with Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell, like there's something about those Irish movies, and I should point out Barry Keoghan as well. Those that I thought Banshees of Inisherin was hysterical. And it's a very, obviously it was nominated for the Academy Award, but most of the people I've talked to about that movie didn't like it or didn't get it. Nobody found it funny. And it brings me back to, I remember the first time I saw something like Fight Club, when I saw Fight Club in the theaters, I walked out of the movie thinking it was hysterical. I thought it was one of the funniest movies I'd seen. And people were shocked. They're like, oh my God, how did you find that funny? And I'm going, I think you guys missed the point. There's comedy to it, and you're completely missing it. Yeah, those, let's see, a couple.
Yeah, if you think it's a style guide for masculinity, you're missing the point.
Yes, very much so. It's not an anti-IKEA ad, no. obviously, there's a whole bunch of ones that Daniel Day-Lewis has done. The one that's technically not an Irish movie, but it deals with immigration, which I thought was fantastic, was Gangs of New York. I absolutely love that movie. And so that falls into this Paddy's Day discussion, same Paddy's Day discussion, even though it's not a movie from Ireland. It's certainly about it.
because I thought one of the first ones that came to my mind was the movie Far and Away with Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
Which very much kind of the same thing. Yeah. So, yeah, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the Leprechaun horror movie franchise and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
But also, like, one of the ones that came to me are the films of Neil Jordan. Even who direct one of our favorite movies, Interview with a Vampire, which is not a movie about Ireland, although he does cast one of his favorites, Stephen Ray. In the role of Santiago, one of the villains in that. But he did The Crying Game, which is one of his most notable ones. Also, The Weird, which is not a beloved movie, but I think I grew to like it because it was on Comedy Central all the time when I was growing up. The movie High Spirits with Daryl Hannah and Steve Guttenberg. and the older Irish actor Peter O'Toole is in that, who just has this hilarious part. And Peter O'Toole is one of my favorite actors of kind of that generation. Tons of actors like that. Cole Meany, who was in Far and Away, and a lot of listeners of the Fire and Water Network will remember him from Star Trek: The Next Generation. Liam Neeson, Gabriel Byrne, Kenneth Branagh, Colin Farrell, which you mentioned, Cillian Murphy, who just won the Oscar for Best Actor.
Yep.
Somebody else who has been on my mind a lot, the actor Andrew Scott, who his most recent work, he had a good movie that just came out called All of Us Strangers. But I first noticed him, he played Moriarty in the recent BBC Sherlock series starring Benedict Cumberbatch. Andrew Scott played Moriarty. But more than that, I recently saw, and you can find this on YouTube, the entire production. Andrew Scott did a production of Hamlet, a stage production of Hamlet, not too recently, as the titular character Hamlet. And it's the best version of Hamlet I've ever seen.
Wow.
And I've seen a lot. His performance, he finds this way of delivering the lines, and especially some of those really memorable monologues, like the or like sounds like the to be or not to be speech. Mm-hmm. He hits that in a way that I've never heard before, and just makes it crystal clear, because the language of Shakespeare is hard for a lot of people to get. Sure. But like, he nails it. And I'm like, this is so clear, and the intention and his performance blew me away. So yeah, Andrew Scott, if you like, again, you can watch it for free on YouTube. It's long. It is like 3.5 or 4 hours or something. So it's an investment, but check out his version of Hamlet on YouTube.
Yeah, there's a couple other names that I thought, obviously, like Pierce Brosnan, you know, people, Richard Harris. This one was funny, and obviously this shows like our kind of taste in dark fiction and movies and stuff. I thought of Stuart Townsend, who played Lestat in the very poorly received
Queen of the Damned. Yeah.
Yeah. But I thought in that particular movie, he did a cool job, and he's an Irish actor. I also like, and again, I should have seen Liam Neeson's pronunciation guide for this.
Kieran Hines. Yeah, and I love him too. He should have been on my list. Yeah.
Yeah, Kieran Hines. Obviously, I loved him in Phantom of the Opera, the movie, and most importantly, probably his most famous role to date, Zack Snyder's Justice League. So
God damn. I was going to say he played Julius Caesar in the HBO Rome series.
Same character. But like I mentioned, in terms of movies and stuff like that, there, you know, again, we mentioned The Commitments, you know, that was up there. There's a whole bunch. It's like I said in the very beginning of this podcast, you know, there's been kind of this cool resurgence of Irish culture. And by the way, there's a whole bunch of, like, I mean, Colin Farrell probably does it about 3 movies a year in Ireland. That aren't released in America. So, you know, those Brendan Gleeson, those guys, if you looked at their IMDb pages and stuff, there's all kinds of stuff that we haven't seen. They're working all the time in Ireland.
And I can't not mention the TV show It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which is set in Patty's Pub.
Yeah.
A show that is entering, I think, its 65th season this year. It's been on for forever.
Yeah. It's catching up to The Simpsons.
All right. Let's get back into our songs and round this one out.
Okay, so the next one, we're coming down to the end. I've only got a couple left. I knew this group was going to be on my list, and I just didn't know where, and I didn't know what song. I ended up settling on Daffodil Lament by the Cranberries. I have decided to leave you. Okay, so as I said, I struggled for the song choice in this one. The Cranberries, believe it or not, are probably my all-time favorite Irish group. I remember when each of their first three or four albums came out, then of course they kind of fell off my radar, but I had all of them and put together one hell of a playlist and loved Dolores O'Riordan's voice and loved the way she double tracked her voice with her own harmonies. So it makes it sound like there's two girls in the group singing and there's not. I really, really love that. I could have gone with a dozen of their popular hits. For the sake of this podcast, it probably would have been easier if I would have gone with Dreams, Linger, Ode to My Family, or of course, Zombie, which everybody knows, which would be powerful in this circumstance. But instead, I had to go with my favorite. And so at the end of the day, if I only get a chance to talk about the Cranberries once, I wanted to choose my favorite song. I chose the song Daffodil Lament off their second album, No Need to Argue. There's something about this song that it's interesting because if anybody's ever heard it, it's a song told in two, maybe three different acts, different movements. The first half of the song is completely different from the second half. And it's got it's got a very dark, somber, eerie, and quiet opening, very similar to something like something you'd hear at the end of a Pearl Jam album, Release. Something like that. It has that kind of sound. And then about the 3 minute mark, maybe the 3 minute, 15 second mark, all of a sudden the song completely switches gears and turns around and becomes an uplifting, beautiful ballad, like a romantic, happy. I don't know how to describe it other than that. But the strange thing about this, the reason I picked this song, it's a long song. It's like 6.5 minutes. The funny thing about this song is every time I've ever made a Cranberries playlist, whether it was to I saw a concert video there. So I tried to put together a playlist based on that, or I got a new album and then had to kind of mix it into my Cranberries playlist or something. Every single time, this song is the last song I put on the list. And it's not intentional, but it always falls like the closer to my love affair with the Cranberries. This is the first song I listened to. I think it was 2017 when we found out that, when Dolores O'Riordan died, she drowned in a Matthew Perry type of death. I think she was drunk and she drowned, but it was from alcohol. I remember that hitting me because the Cranberries were one of those early 90s groups when women kind of started to step into their own. Ryan, you and I've talked about this on previous podcasts before, but the early 90s, all of a sudden women kind of came into prominence, and it was they adopted that in the field of rock and roll. Women stepped out and said, anything you can do, we can do better. And we've talked about this, and we loved this about them. And we loved the chicks that would show up with jeans, Doc Martens, and flannels. And not try to sexualize themselves for attention. Dolores O'Riordan falls right into that category. And I remember when she passed, this was the first song I listened to. And it was sad and heartbreaking, yet made me smile at the end. There's something about this song that takes me on a roller coaster.
Yeah, and you mentioned it because my strongest memory of this was the first time I heard it before I got the album No Need to Argue, which I played a lot. I mean, I listened to the hell out of that thing. Mm-hmm. But before I got that, you sent me a mixtape of those female singers, and a lot of them that were out there around the time, mm-hmm. like Juliana Hatfield and Liz Phair and the Cranberries. And there was probably five or six Cranberries songs on that tape, on both sides. And this was one of those. So I heard it. It has been a really long time since I've done a deep dive on the Cranberries other than Linger and Zombie, which kind of just come up in, rotation of just listening to pop songs from that era again. So I hadn't heard this song in forever. I forgot how long it was. I forgot its sort of segmented structure and how it's in these different acts. It's a damn epic song. the way it's kind of tricky. It's very intricate. It's very also beautiful. It's both heartbreaking and uplifting as a breakup song, but also a breakup song with a positive note at the end and a kind of sense of happiness and resolution. It's a great song, very powerful one. I wouldn't have picked this one for the Cranberries, but I'm glad you did, because otherwise I might not have heard this one in however many years. So I'm glad that I heard this one again.
Yeah, good, good, good. I'm glad you reacted to it the same way I did. And again, I know that that was a risk because obviously for the sake of an Irish podcast, obviously they've done more things that are more Irish, and Zombie would have been, Zombie's about the wars in Ireland and their popular hits, Ode to My Family. It's one of the most beautiful songs. I mean, the Cranberries are epic, and I love everything about them. But this one, hopefully, maybe some of you out there listening are going to do, going to check this out after the podcast tonight. Maybe you haven't heard this song before.
Yeah. All right. The last song on my list for this episode, I'm going with The Pogues. It's not A Fairy Tale of New York this time. I'm talking about another one of their beloved songs, A Rainy Night in Soho.
I've been loving you a long time. Down all the years, down all the days. And I've cried for all your troubles. Smile, it's your funny little way. We watched our friends grow up together. And we saw them as they fell. Some of them fell into heaven. Some of them fell into hell.
And again, capping this theme, I believe the first time I heard this song was a cover. this one by Nick Cave. And Nick Cave was very good friends with Shane McGowan, the lead singer of The Pogues, who passed away last year. And they collaborated a couple of times. Shane McGowan did backup vocals on some of Nick Cave's songs that I like. So they knew each other. As I mentioned in last year's Very Dearly Christmas, McGowan died last year. This song, I knew it, but it kind of forgot about it. It re-entered my awareness because Nick Cave actually played this song at McGowan's funeral. There were two songs played at the funeral. Nick Cave played this one, and then Glenn Hansard, the guy from Once, another Irish artist, Glenn Hansard played Fairy Tale of New York with other members of the Pogues, kind of with him, like he did the front of that. So both of those songs were performed during the funeral. Of all of the songs that I have picked, this one I think sounds the most traditional in its sound with the use of whistles and pipes and its orchestration. Also the narrative oral traditional style of not having a chorus. It's just verses. It's just verses after verse.
Yeah, it's almost like Bob Dylan wrote it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's my favorite song on the list. This has a very folk feel. With as he's like the Bob Dylan-esque, just like of just verse repeating verse, not having the same melody is repeated. It's very simple that way, but in that simplicity, I do think there's an earworm quality. And once I heard this, I was like, I couldn't get this out of my head. It's been with me since last December, and it's not a complicated song by any means, but there is a kind of profound quality to it. And the last verse is one of it blows me away. And the lyrics are, now this song is nearly over. We may never find out what it means. Still, there's a light I hold before me. You're the measure of my dreams. And like thinking about, I guess coming from somebody who's like recently died, but thinking about encapsulating a life and what that could mean at the end of life, thinking about the song nearly over as your life might be coming to an end. We might not find out what it means. We don't know the meaning of all this thing. So how do we measure our accomplishments? How do we know what is valuable in this life or what we have done that may have meaning? And it can only be our love, the way we connect with each other and something like that. It brings me to tears. This song it continues to floor me. I haven't stopped listening to it since December. It's this beautiful little one.
Yeah. You mentioned obviously Nick Cave did it. I've heard a couple of other people do covers of this as well. Bono has done it. Elvis Costello has done it. I think Elvis Costello
produced it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was going to say, I think he was either on the record or it had something to do with it. Yeah. Johnny Depp has covered this song, playing live.
Yep,
I think Yeah, my notes on this one are pretty simple. You know, it's all your Pogue. So every time you pick a Pogue song, it sounds like Christmas to me. It sounds like that's just it. The song. And that's the way it feels. It's quintessential Pogues. You know, it sounds very much like this. They are an Irish rock band, and you hear it a lot in some of this falls into that same category. I love the song. I think a lot of people love the song. This is one of their bigger songs, yeah, more known songs. So I've got a cool story that I want to throw out there. And this, I don't think you've never heard this before. I just heard this a couple of weeks ago. So a guy that I work with, his name's Jerry. He's a former comedian, entertainer, and now he's in the business world. He's an older guy that has some cool stories about celebrities. He's when you hung out in circles at like the Laugh Factory or the comedy club and stuff like that. When you've been in those circles, you end up hanging out with musicians and actors that come to the shows. He told me a story once prior to us deciding we were going to do this podcast, probably about a month ago, maybe a couple weeks ago, about a night that he hung out with Shane McGowan. And I was like, wait a minute, the guy from the Pogues? And he goes, oh yeah, you know who the Pogues are? I'm like, yeah, I'm Irish. Of course I know who they are. And so he started, I was like, what happened? He was, oh my God, it was everything you would think of. He said, it was hanging out with you. He said, we were in Manhattan. We were in like New York. And we were, he's not friends with Shane McGowan, but they had a mutual friend that was kind of leading the group around, taking cabs, going to hit all these Irish bars. And he said it was funny because the first thing this is Jerry telling me the story. He said, the funniest thing about this is we were going to these dive New York Irish pubs. And Shane McGowan from the Pogues walks in and nobody there knew who he was. So they would start messing with people by putting a song in the jukebox. They'd play a Pogues song in the jukebox. People in the bar would start to sing it and nobody knew who Shane McGowan was. So he was just saying this was just awesome. And he's like, and sure enough, it's what you anticipate. You know, when you think of like hanging out with a rock star, you know, it gets pretty debaucherous. Now make that an Irish rock star. He was like, so it was a lot of whiskey, sloppy drunk, cigarettes, you know, like you just he had bad breath, smelled like smoke and whiskey and stuff. At some point they get to blackout stage. So the next morning, Jerry wakes up. It's about 5 o'clock in the morning. The sun's shining through. And he's woken up by a phone buzzing on the table. And he's like, that's not my phone, but oh my God, I got to stop it. So he picked it up and he was like, hello. And it was Shane McGowan's wife. So she was calling Shane McGowan's phone. And she's yelling at Jerry, being like, where's my husband? Blah, blah, blah. Now, I don't know about Shane McGowan's story. I don't know if he's married. I don't know if they were still together. I don't know anything about that. But Shane McGowan's wife is yelling at Jerry saying, where's my husband? Jerry immediately goes into that protective boys club mode where he's like, I have no idea where he is, but I don't want you like, what if he went and hooked up with another chick? Like, I don't know. So he's like, I got a cover for this. He's like, oh, I think he's brushing his teeth or something. And she's like, get him to call me back and everything. And Jerry hangs up. And now he's thinking, okay, I'm in a hotel room. I don't remember how he got here. I have no idea where Shane McGowan is, but he could be anywhere in the city. And then out through the door, Shane McGowan comes in with a glass of orange juice and comes walking into the room. He went and got something and he looked fine. He looked fine at 5 o'clock in the morning after partying all night to the point where everybody else blacked out. They don't remember. And Shane McGowan comes walking in and then he ended up, they exchanged numbers with Jerry. He went home and left. And then Jerry said that he ended up texting him like a week later and said, so, hey, thanks for taking care of me that night. And Jerry's like, I did? Like, oh, I have no idea what you're talking about. But Jerry was telling me the story. So we agreed to do this podcast. I texted Jerry before we recorded tonight. And I said, hey, remember that story you told me about the Pogues? And he was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. I was like, can I mention that? Because I didn't want to say any of this stuff without permission. And I said, can I bring this up on the podcast? He goes, yeah, absolutely. It really happened. He goes, and he's dead now. So that was, I'm I guess, you know, less than 60 degrees away from Shane McGowan. And you are.
There you go. Yeah. This sounds cruel to say about a person recently deceased, but I can't think of a worse excuse to say in the panicky moment than he's brushing his teeth, because Shane McGowan was not a poster child for Crest toothpaste or anything like that. Like, when you think about the line from The Simpsons when the dentist is trying to scare the kids with looking at the big book of British smiles.
Yeah. Well, there's, you know, it's funny because as Jerry told me the story, he must have repeated a couple of times how bad his breath smelled. So maybe subconsciously when she's saying where he is, he might have been hoping and praying, I hope he's in the bathroom brushing his teeth. That could have been a Freudian slip.
Nice. All right. Well, take us away with the last song of the show.
Okay. So this one, you know, we're doing an Irish podcast. We're doing a St. Paddy's Day podcast. We're talking about all the famous Irish groups and people, you know, for all these other reasons. So the final group on our list is going to come as a surprise to nobody. The song itself and the reasons why hopefully will be a surprise. I'm choosing the song Bad by U2. That you and Omar did a podcast on YouTube, and hopefully your listeners listened to it. It was quite good. Very long, quite good. I don't want to retread the same information. I don't want to spend a whole night talking about YouTube, but we couldn't do a St. Patrick's Day or an Irish or a Daily Family holiday podcast without talking about YouTube in this circumstance. Like them or not, they're probably the most important band to ever come out of Ireland. Like the Cranberries. Like I said before, I struggled choosing the right song for this episode. Obviously, for political war-type reasons, Sunday Bloody Sunday and New Year's Day both popped on my radar immediately. But at the end of the day, if this is, like I said about the Cranberries, if this is the only time I'm ever going to talk about U2 on a podcast, I had to go with what I consider my favorite song. And it's another epic. It's another, like the Cranberries song. This is an epic monster of a song, lengthwise, structure-wise. I think I first heard this song going back. This is ironic that we're coming full circle. I think I first heard the song during the Live Aid concert that Bob Geldof put together.
Yeah.
And I remember watching Bono jumping down into the crowd and hugging and kissing fans as the band rocked out the second half of the instrumental portion of the song and made it like a 15-minute anthem in a stadium. I'll never forget how good it sounded live, and I'll never forget the structure of the song, and it had all those quintessential like U2 things, like the rhythm section of Bono and Adam, that throbbing sort of thumping, building to something that this song has as it goes. You feel something coming, you feel it building to a crescendo. It's got the classic edge guitar part, which is heavily echoed, you know, so it sounds reverb and echo, so it sounds every note he hits rings more than once. So it sounds like he's playing really, really fast, and he's not, because it's echoing every note. And then Bono's classic, the thing that made him in some of U2's biggest hits, he had the same kind of template for singing where he had low register verses. And then by the time it got to the climax of the song, he was in the stratosphere in terms of his range. So it has all those elements to the song. And I remember seeing that live and being like, oh, my God, this is amazing. I also remember this weird thing at Bono at Live Aid. And I don't know if we've ever talked about this before, but there was this weird passing of the torch from the Police to U2. Because I think, if memory serves, I think this was the Police's last live performance. And they were breaking up. And U2 came on as the Police finished their set, and Sting passed the mic to Bono. And it was this weird symbolic, we're done, you're taking over for the European market, like of this global spokesperson type of political stance kind of thing. I just remember feeling like, wow, this is like weirdly symbolic. So for all those reasons, obviously that was my like introduction to U2, and that was my introduction to the song. The last thing I want to say about this song, other than the fact that it's my favorite U2 song of all time. And again, there's probably a lot of people, you know, you can love or you can hate Bono. You can love or you can hate the band for all these other reasons. You can hate their stance against things. You can think he's full of himself and it's all whatever. If I was ever to introduce somebody to U2 who didn't know anything about the band, as much as I love the album Achtung Baby, I probably wouldn't pick a song off that because I don't think that's stereotypically their sound. I would probably choose this. I think that this is the most snapshot picture of U2. And so this would be the song I would choose.
I get that. Yeah, that's I can definitely understand and probably co-sign that. I think you're right. It's an amazing song. It's one of my favorite U2 songs. And as I talked about with them, I love the band. So this one is, when I say it's one of my favorites, it's very high on my list of like all time favorite songs across the board. Every live version of this, no matter where you find it, whether it's the Live Aid or the version on Rattle and Hum or the Wide and Awake in America version that they came out with, the live versions are just so epic and incredible. Yeah. And they kind of take this already amazing song to new heights. When you were in your band in high school, did you play this song? Bullet the Blue Sky, didn't you?
Yeah, we played Bullet Blue Sky and With or Without You.
Okay.
Those were the two songs we played. We didn't do Bad.
Okay. All
right. Which I should have. I wish I did. I remember this one. I think I honestly, and this is embarrassing to admit this, I think the reason we probably didn't play this song was because I couldn't figure out how to get the echo effect so that I, you know, when you first listen to the song, you're just learning how to play the guitar. You think you have to move your hand about five times faster than you really do.
Right.
And you realize it's an effect that's doing all the work. And Mark Andrews could not sing this part. So this, even if I wanted to, even zero population growth, that was our band. Even if I wanted to be like, hey, I'm going to bring this band, you know, because I was into U2 at the time. Mm-hmm. I want to do it Bad. I think he would probably listen to it and be like, yeah, no.
Well, folks, that is our track list for this episode. Now, obviously, we only went with 10 songs. It's just a smattering of the thing. We didn't talk about Van Morrison, but we covered him. We covered him last year on a very daily Valentine's Day. So I kind of felt like we were there. We've talked about the Commitments on Soundtrack Selections and Glenn Hansard too, specifically. So I feel like we've covered a lot of these other things, but there's tons of bands and artists that we didn't mention, but I'm happy with the snapshot that we got.
Yeah, me too. And not necessarily all like Irish groups per se, but you know, Ed Sheeran, I think Tom and I have talked about this on one of our covers. He does a great version of a song called Galway Girl, which is a very traditional Irish song, even though he's not from Ireland. And then there's bands like Snow Patrol, which I've talked about in a previous podcast about how I got duped into going to a concert. But this is just a snapshot, like you said, of the groups. I think that these were the ones that were influencing. These were the ones that, you know, kind of stuck out to us. We opened the show tonight with Dropkick Murphys,
right,
which everybody knows from The Departed. But they also have an amazing Christmas song. If you guys want to dig deep into the Dropkick Murphys and look up on YouTube, look up their Christmas song. It's very Gaelic Stormish in the sense that you put a bunch of people together in a room drinking for a holiday, everybody's going to fight.
All right, folks. Fire and Water Records is a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Feedback for the show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com, as well as the Facebook page for Fire and Water Records. Special thanks to our Patreon supporters. For information on how you can support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, visit patreon.com/FWpodcasts. All music clips and quoted lyrics are used for entertainment purposes. Please support the artists and their work by purchasing or downloading the songs legally. Thanks for listening, and happy St. Patrick's Day.
Ooh, where's me gold?
Now the song is nearly over. We may never find out what it means.